Welcome to GLAAD, your spatial fix for geography, life, and data. This podcast is brought to you by the Science of Cities and Regions program at the Alan Turing Institute. I'm Levi, your host for today, and I'm with you remotely with Danny.
Hi.
And Rachel.
Hello.
We do something a little different every time, but there's always a healthy dose of all things geography, life, and data. Today, we're giving you a sneak peek behind the editor's desk at a peer-reviewed journal. Many academics publish, but organizing reviews, reproduction materials, and making the first and final call on a manuscript is a very unique experience. We hope to answer your questions about life as an editor and talk a little bit about the efforts that we've seen or done to make the process a little bit fairer, faster, and more human. So, to start us off today, I thought we might talk a little bit about our personal experiences of the journals that we edit and kind of what we do. So Rachel, would you mind talking a little bit about your experience as the editor-in-chief at Geographical Analysis?
Sure. Well, I've been editor. So at Geographical Analysis, we just refer to it as editor, although sometimes I'll put editor-in-chief in just to make it clear what my actual role is. But I've been doing this since, I think, summer of 2017. So I'm well into actually my third little chunk of a term. So I'm actually nearing the end of when I will be at the helm of Geographical Analysis. But we're a journal that has traditionally had an editor and then associate editors and then an editorial board, which is, if you look at websites for journals, pretty typical. What makes us a little bit unusual is that our associate editors don't actually associate edit anything, and I'm not sure that they ever did. So they're there if I need them. And I'm sure that we'll get into the weeds of sort of how this works logistically speaking. But what it means is that I actually handle papers from the start all the way to the end without anyone else weighing in or making a recommendation other than the reviewers.
Gotcha. So it works a little bit differently, I think, at different journals. Danny, how does the process work at the Journal of the Royal Statistical Society Series A?
Yeah, so I'm involved on editorial roles in two journals, Environment and Planning B with you, Levi, and the Journal of the Royal Statistical Society Series A, which is the statistics in society, so the more applications to social stats. And both are actually rather different. So JRSS has two main editors. I don't remember now, actually. I probably should have got the right word. I'm not sure if Keith is the word, but there are two editors that make the final call. And this is the important part we'll get later. But they ultimately decide, is this paper accepted or is it rejected? But they do that with the help of reviewers, like in most journals, and with the help of an associate editor. And that's my role. So the way it works is I will get an invite for handling a paper from one of these two chief editors. And then I manage that submission as if I was the main editor, with the difference that at the end of the day, what I do is I write a paragraph that summarizes what the reviewers say and what my view is based on those reviewers and the paper itself. And I pass that on to the editor, who makes the final decision. And this is different. Maybe you'll say later a bit more, Levi, about it, Environment and Planning B, but it's slightly different than that.
How often does it happen that the editor-in-chief will make a different decision than what the associate editor has recommended? Is that a thing?
I don't know. I mean, I don't have the numbers. From my experience, what does happen is, or the way I approach that role is, I'm not as strict with the call because I don't have to make the final call. I will be saying things like, I think this is more like a reject for A and B and C, but I could see it as a major revision, or the other way around. I could see this. I think I would do a revise and resubmit here, but I would understand if you rejected it.
So you're kind of like a reviewer.
I'm a reviewer of the reviewers. If that makes sense. It's a really interesting process because it's an additional hierarchical layer, which you can like or not. But what I do like is that it offload some of the work from the chief editors, but they still get, I think it still gives consistency across the board, but ultimately the final call comes down to two people rather than, I think we're 12 or 15 associate editors. But you still have someone spending quality time with each paper. I mean, every editor spends quality time, but you know, our role is much more focused on a handful of papers that are also more aligned, and that's the other benefit, is more aligned with our areas. So JRSSA gets a really wide set of domains. There's a lot from economics to sociology, political science, more statistics, and sometimes is, you know, fairly different types of papers. So the idea is that the associate editors have a bit more of domain expertise and they're better placed to make final recommendation, while the chief editor or the main editor at the end of the day oversee the general tier of the journal. That's as I see it.
I'm going to guess that you, in those both of those journals, that you see a lot more submissions than I probably do at GA, though. So at Geographical Analysis, we're talking maybe 130 to 150 total submissions a year. So I'm not overwhelmed by submissions. And you may handle that as an associate editor, I'm going to guess, also. In other words, that the magnitude is probably much, much larger at these journals.
There are different journals. I don't have the numbers. EPB Levi might have better memory than me. It's, what were we, 500, 600 last year, I think?
Yes.
And JRS says I can't remember on the top of my head. But yes, I think part of why there are wider areas, particularly JRSS, it covers a lot of domains and a lot of disciplines that you get submissions from, and it is a different kind of thing.
At a journal like EPB, where Danny and I edit as well, there's a similar hierarchical structure, but it's not as... The associate editor has more liberty to make decisions. So in our particular system, if you send a manuscript to Environment and Planning B, our editor-in-chief, or managing editor, Linda C., she takes it and sends it to one of the associate editors as like almost area editors in a similar way. Or rejects them outright. That's true. But then as an associate editor, people like Danny and I have the latitude to make the decision. And I think that probably arises because the journal just gets big for one person to see all the papers and make all the decisions.
Can you, as associate editor at EPB, which is how people often refer to Environment and Planning B, can you desk reject when it comes to you?
Yes.
So there are two stages of potential desk reject.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Levi and I only see what gets Linda's filter at EPB. And then we still have a fair share of desk rejection. Maybe that's something we can talk later.
But yeah. I mean, that makes...
There is even an associate editor who's just kind of specialized in trying to figure out the edge cases where it's not an obvious desk reject, but it's probably a desk reject. There's an editor who's responsible for kind of making those harder decisions. So, but that's just the system that's evolved over time at EPB, per se.
Yeah, I mean, I think we forget sometimes how institutional and cultural these things are, that they're just groups of people who come together and figure out how to manage a workflow. Yes. And so there are no rules about how a journal is supposed to work, with the exception that when you submit a paper, you should get a decision in a timely fashion. But other than that, I think we're all free to organize ourselves as we see fit. And I think we should keep it that way.
Yeah, I was going to say how much history is embedded into each journal and where it came from and how it's grown and how it's decided to grow. I think it's a really interesting backstory that you don't always get, but it's an interesting one to when you hear it.
So with that in mind, the practices that happen or the systems that you encounter after you submit your manuscript to a journal can vary widely. So warning listener here that our experiences at the various journals we've worked with over our careers will not be representative of all journals in any discipline. However, what we want to try and do with this episode is give kind of an insight about what happens once you kind of review your final page proofs and you hit that submit button, right? So at all of these journals, it goes up to someone, either that person is Rachel or it's a further managing editor above, in the case of Danny and I. And there's a flow that goes from person to person, and then it sits with us. So there's multiple people that have to take a look at it and then process it before it gets finally to that what we might call an acting editor, someone who's responsible for soliciting feedback on the submission. And in this case, we have a couple of pieces of information. We usually have the journal article itself. It would be really hard to get reviewers if we couldn't see that. But we also have a cover letter, And a cover letter is like a shorter document that you write to describe the paper that you've written. And some people don't attach these at all. Some people just put very perfunctory short explanations about what is in the paper in those cover letters. Some editors don't read them. Other editors do. When you're thinking about trying to explain the paper, I think it's a critical piece of information that helps an editor understand what reviewers to solicit. Is there any other information you guys like to see in those kinds of documents?
Well, I think this is really funny because I barely look at the cover letter. Like I open the cover letter to see what's there, just out of curiosity. Like sometimes the paper will be clearly, like, at best adjacent to a geographical analysis audience. And I'll think, I wonder if they just have a generic cover letter that they're submitting everywhere, and even if they've put the name of my journal in their cover letter. So I suppose a warning here to people submitting papers is to at least make sure that you're referencing the correct journal when you do submit a cover letter. But I mostly discount those. I think there are two things that traditionally a cover letter has to have. It has to say that it hasn't been submitted elsewhere for publication and that it is your own work. And even now with online systems, I think you're usually asked to give that information elsewhere with radio boxes. So I tend to not look so much at the cover letter. I do. So what I'm presented with is an interface that shows me a list of all the papers awaiting my attention. And one of those is a link where I can just go directly to the paper. So what I try to force myself to do is to go directly to the manuscript link and not look at any other information so that I'm not thinking about author names, author countries, author affiliations as I'm reading those papers. But to be honest, usually within the first two or three pages of a paper, I know whether or not it's a good fit for geographical analysis. And if I know that it's not going to be a good fit, I'll skim the rest of the paper, but I don't do much more than that. If I'm unsure, I'm going to have to spend a little bit more time on what to do with the paper, but I think maybe we can maybe talk about that in a moment.
Yeah, I was also going to say I don't place a whole lot of weight on cover letters for a couple of reasons. I do in some cases, though. The main one is that I think ultimately the proof is in the pudding. The paper should be standalone. So if there's any critical information you would like the editor to know about your paper, it should go in the paper. There are some exceptions to that. In some cases, and particularly in Environmental Planning B, we now have a section that I handle on data products and open source code. And it's a different type of paper. They're much shorter, much more to the point. And I do pay attention to the cover letters because there's a bit more flexibility in that format. And in some cases, they will say, the artifact that this paper is talking about is available here, or this is how we envision a fit, because it's a new section. So in those cases, I think it can be useful. The other case where I look at the cover letter is on revisions. So when you get it for the second time after revisions, I like to check quickly just to make sure sometimes they will list, we've attached this, and this, and I can only see two items out of three, they say. So in my graph got lost, mm-hmm. It might have been on the system. So I want to make sure that they have provided what they say they provide before I go back to the reviewers, because otherwise it's going to delay extra. The reviewers will look at it and come back and say, I was expecting this document and it's not here.
Yeah, that's interesting. So what I usually do on a revision is look at, I don't know if you use Scholar One for Environment and Planning B, but that's what we use. So I'll have the cover letter link under revision, but I'll also have the author's response. And so what I usually go to is the author's response one, because a lot of times people have not anonymized that information, but also sometimes they've put their entire response into that box and other times they haven't. And if there's nothing in that box, I have to go look to make sure that it's actually in the proof when you read the paper and that it's maybe somewhere way at the back. And I can see why cover letters used to be really important, right? Before we had these management systems, the cover letter had to do all of this heavy lifting for us. It had to do the guarantees that it wasn't submitted elsewhere, but it also had to maybe say if you wanted particular reviewers or you definitely didn't want other reviewers. It had to basically make the case that we're able to get in lots of other ways through the management system these days.
Yeah, that's a good point. So many of the management systems as well, you submit to a journal will allow you to provide either recommended reviewers, people that you think would be useful but possibly critical voices on the manuscript, or restricted reviewers, people that you think would be unlikely to give you a fair review. Between the paper, the cover letter, and then those sets of recommended or restricted reviewers, that's generally the information that we have available to the editor. And I personally like the process of getting a recommended reviewer. Even if I don't use the recommended reviewer, I tend to kind of look for people that the recommended reviewer is similar to in some way, so maybe has published on a topic, to try and get a sense of why the person thinks the recommended reviewer would be a good reviewer for the manuscript. And again, it's part of the framing of the document, that you get it through the submission system, but I at least find it helpful. But it can be really challenging, right? Because when you restrict reviewers in a narrow area, it can be difficult to find enough people.
Yeah, I was going to say, I also find it useful to get reviewer recommendations, not because I would necessarily follow them, but because it helps me see how the author frames their paper and what they think their paper contributes to or is part of and speaks to. And sometimes the I find less useful, but the ones, and they're less common, at least for me also, but the recommendations for not to enlist as a reviewer are also interesting, because sometimes they have to do with personal relationships. So those are not necessarily as useful, but they are useful if that exists, because it helps me aim for a good mix of reviewers that tries to get all the views or all the expertise that requires to access or to evaluate the paper.
Yeah, so I think I use the recommended reviewers section in a variety of ways. So especially for the last 2 or 3 years, when I look at that and there are no recommended reviewers, there is a little thought process that goes through my head where I think either these authors are not living in the 21st century, that is, they have no idea how hard it is to find reviewers, or they're really new to the system and don't really understand that this is a thing that you're actually allowed and encouraged to do. And sometimes it's not clear to me what's driving the lack of reviewer suggestions. But I would say, as if there's one takeaway from this episode, it's that it is a very helpful exercise, as Danny says, to go through and think about who would be appropriate reviewers for this paper. And if you find yourself unable to articulate who the right reviewers are for this paper and for this journal, you may not be quite ready to submit yet. I actually think you should know who you're in conversation with, and you should know who might be able to provide a good and fair assessment of your paper. That said, I think I get two categories at least of recommended reviewers. I get the ones where somebody clearly knows what conversation they're in, and then I get the one where it's obvious that these are people that they know. I mean, we're not a massive community, and sometimes they're people they know in a sense that is closer than I would ever find acceptable for a reviewer. But I really appreciate having the suggested reviewers. And I would say the other thing that I do, because of the way the interface works, there are lots of different windows you can click through, is that similarly to looking at a paper before I look at authors, I also try and make a guess when I'm still looking at the manuscript of who might be good reviewers before I look at the recommended reviewers. And so if there's overlap, I am pretty inclined to choose those people because I would have chosen them anyway. And I generally start, you know, sometimes a paper will be obvious who would make good reviewers. A lot of times, because the fit just isn't fantastic, or my normal reviewers, when something is super obvious, my normal reviewers have already been asked to review a lot recently, I'll go to the references, and I just start looking at the references for anything that's after like 2018 and looks related and looks in our field. It also helps me do a little bit of a check on what kinds of literature they're citing. And this is another case for where, you know, if I'm not 100% sure that a paper is going to fit in geographical analysis, and fit for me means, does it, you know, is this a GA type paper, but also means, am I going to find reviewers for this paper? And am I going to find reviewers who are actually going to return a review? And I have to say, if I cannot find any reviewers for your paper, and I'm pretty sure that nobody in geography is going to want to review this, I desk reject. And sometimes I'll hear back from authors who find this to be really unfair, but I think you don't want to wait 8 months for me to come back and tell you that I'm rejecting your paper. I'm really doing you a favor at the outset. So I do think that this sort of this exercise of thinking about who could review tells you whether or not you're really fitting the journal. Because if you can only think of mathematicians who should be reviewing this paper that you've just submitted to a geography journal, you're off, right? They might return a perfectly usable review for the paper, but not for a geography journal. And so that's sort of, I think, how I think about the reviewer choice process a little bit.
Sure, sure. And I think, too, there's another kind of suggested reviewer that we see in the wild, which is the highest, most prominent person in the field that your manuscript is.
Yeah.
And my suggestion to any prospective submitter is to not do that, because it is almost not worth putting them down on the forum.
Yeah.
Well,
Paul Krugman only has so many hours in the day.
The ones I usually get are Luke Anselin. Yeah, Luke Anselin is the number one, where I just think, sorry, Luke, if you happen to listen to our PAP podcast, but also your bar is going to be really high. So unless you've submitted the world's very best paper ever, maybe choosing somebody who's world-renowned on the topic is just not a good choice. One, they're unlikely to say yes. And two, they may hold you to an incredibly high standard that you're unlikely to meet, to be totally honest. And so finding people who are really in that milieu that you're actually active in, like when you go to a conference and you're in a session, who are the other people in the room presenting with you, but also listening to you? This is going to give you, I think, a more realistic sense of who you're in conversation with and who might make a good reviewer.
Okay, so then let's say the editor picks reviewers and these review requests get sent. And sometimes I will say, like Levi was suggesting, is not a linear process. Even if you end up with reviewers, it might not be your first try. It's a second round, or you try a wide range. Actually, I'm curious how you two do this.
Me too.
I tend to pick a long list of potential reviewers and then pick three or four at a time.
Oh.
So I never get a paper with six reviews because I think is wasting reviewers' time. But I also have a quick way when I have one rejected to just go and send the next one, so there's less time waste.
That's
my approach.
And I think this does depend on the systems that editors use, because when I guest edited for Journal of Geographical Systems, they used a different platform that was a Springer platform. And that one actually allowed you to queue up alternate reviewers so that as soon as somebody turned down a review request, it automatically issued the next request. Anyway, I think that that's how it worked. My system doesn't work that way. And so usually what I hope for is I'm going to have two obvious potential reviewers and I'll just get them invited right away. Sometimes it'll be clear to me who the number three and number four could be if these two don't work, and I'll go ahead and queue them so that they're there so that I don't have to do the work when I go back to try and think who would be a good fit. But to be honest, I don't usually do more than that. And usually I handle the reviewer search process as a piece of my editorial work almost every week. And I think we're going to talk about sort of what this looks like. But when I go in and I'm doing my job as editor, one of them clearly is to keep the manuscripts moving with reviewers. And I'll just go in and look to see this week who's had two review requests turned down, who needs another one to be able to move forward. Sometimes when I'm hitting like seven or eight people who've declined, then I start to get a little bit more nervous and I might put more people in there because I know I'm starting to reach the point where I have to be a lot more efficient about getting someone to say yes. Because for most manuscripts, I'm going to want two reviews. Yeah. If these days I hit, the number varies. It kind of depends on what my initial gut feeling was about the fit of the paper and its quality. But sometimes if I hit, I don't know, let's say 8 to 15 thumbs down on willingness to review, I will issue a rejection. And it is a very much a gut feeling, and it depends on lots of different factors, but usually it's already been several weeks. So you can imagine how long it's taken to get to 10 declines to review. And so then I think maybe I was wrong about the fit of this paper. Well, so I think many things. One is that I think maybe I was wrong about the fit of the paper, and that can happen. It happens a lot in geographical analysis and maybe in EPB also, where a paper is a little bit technical, and it could be technical in a GI science sort of way, but often it's technical in a statistics way. And those are hard papers for geographical analysis because they might be something about a spatial statistic, and we clearly like spatial statistics at geographical analysis, but we are not a statistics journal. And so sometimes I'll get something where the statistic itself belongs in geographical analysis, but the way that they've written the paper didn't.
Yeah.
And I know that if I issue a desk reject, the authors will quite fairly say, but this is the journal of, you know, local spatial statistics. And I'll say, yeah, but not statistics.
Yes. Local spatial, maybe not and statistics.
So, yeah. And so sometimes I misjudge on that. And I think I internalize it a lot. Often I think this was a failure on my part when the paper came in. But I think the other failure, and increasingly this is one that I try and remind my students about and my postdocs and basically anyone who asks me, as I say, if your title and your abstract do not attract reviewers, people these days are not going to say yes to reviewing. And so sometimes I think this is a little bit on the authors. Who would want to review this paper? I have no idea what it is about by looking at the title. And so I think this is a charge to authors to make sure that somebody's going to volunteer to read your paper actually wants to. Like, your job is to make it clear what you're doing, why you're doing it, and to hopefully keep them reading all the way through.
Click and accept.
Yeah.
On the request.
Yes.
So let's assume that we have reviewers that have clicked accept, and then they go to read it and they write a review. There's a lot of art. There's a bit of science, but a lot of art, I think, that goes into writing a good review. And it probably varies by journal. It definitely varies by editor. What are the things that you think across the board, what is the 80% or 70% that is probably useful for every or most journals, most editors, when you take a review from a referee, Levi?
I know that for me, one thing that I really like is when often in journal systems, a reviewer has the ability to provide text that just goes to the editor, and then text that's shared with the submitter. And I find it actually quite helpful to get a little bit of less formal but still clear knowledge from the reviewer about what they actually thought, like a kind of direct, we're in the hallway of a conference presentation, oh, did you like that or did you not, kind of chat. I find that really helpful to make a decision, because it's often the case that review reports can be very long and very detailed, sometimes technical, about the specifics of a literature that I'm familiar with but not an expert in. So it's usually helpful to again, provide a little bit more context to the formal communication in order to make a kind of decision about whether or not your major reject stacks up against someone else, or major revision stacks up against someone else's minor revision, kind of thing.
Yeah, I tend not to worry so much about the actual decision between major and minor, but that's a different piece of the conversation. There are two pieces of information that I see when I have reviews returned. One of them is this text to the editor, which sometimes I find useful. Although I will say I was given advice a while ago about it was about a review that I had done where I hadn't really liked the paper. But I didn't want to be a jerk in the review. And so I said, here are all the reasons, you know, why this paper could be, where it could be revised, where it could be improved. But I didn't want to say, reject this paper. I put that in the text to the editor. And when I saw the editor at a conference, he said, you know, I understand why people want to do that. But when you put that useful information there, it's very hard for me to go back to an author and tell them, because they don't get to see that information. So if you're reviewing a paper, you should be constructive and kind, treat people the way you want to be treated, but you should be very clear what you think of the paper, because otherwise you're dumping that on the editor, who may get a really hard time from authors who are going to think that the editor just isn't a nice person, yeah, or didn't read the reviews or didn't read the paper or just hasn't understood the big picture of what you're doing. So that's one piece of information that I definitely look at. But the other thing is that reviewers also have to click a box that says, I am willing to review a revision of this paper. And that to me is almost more important than anything that goes into the review. Because if somebody has given a whole list of changes and sounded generally positive in their review, but the paper clearly needs a lot of work and they never want to see it again, that's telling me, okay, like this paper, when it comes back as a revision, I basically have to be able to make a decision on it without it going back out to review. Do I actually think this paper is going to meet that bar? Because I think refusal to review, especially when somebody's recommended reject and refusal to see again, is essentially saying it's a strong steer to reject a paper, especially if two reviewers have done that, I have almost no recourse. Yeah. And then the reviews themselves. Yeah. I like it when people are nice. I like it when they're not jerks. I like it when they provide suggestions for improvement and are very clear on what it would take to get a paper to a particular level. If it is not a good fit for the journal, I like to know that. It doesn't mean that I'm going to listen to it because I may have my own ideas, but I like to know whether the fit is good, whether the quality is good, where they should improve it. I mean, think about, if you're listening to this, think about what you like to see when you look at a reviewer report. What you want is a very clear roadmap of what it's going to take to make this a publishable paper. You want to know where to get started on your changes. Editors largely want something very similar. We want to know, what is it that this reviewer is picking up on? And is it big stuff? Is it little stuff?
Yeah, a couple of points. One, on the secret box, I think it's useful, as like you're saying, as long as the view is aligned with the public box. So it might give you a bit more context. It might give you sort of more direct expression of their opinion that is not particularly constructive in but in the public one. Or it might give you something about their relationship to the paper. Like, I've seen this in another journal, for example, and this is what happened. But it needs to be aligned with the other box, because otherwise, exactly, it makes decisions look less clear where they're coming from. And then the other thing, and this is very much a personal point, I'm happy with reviewers not being clear on the recommendation, because ultimately I don't think it's their job.
Right.
What I do like is, like you say, Rachel, that they say, they tell me what the context of the paper is, what is the value, what do they see as the contribution, and then with that information, my job is making the decision, is this a good fit for the journal and is it good to go or not? What is definitely not useful is reviews that said, I would reject these and that's a review.
Yes.
Or I would reject this because it's bad, or accept it as is fantastic. Fine, that's not your job. It's a reviewer has to review, not decide. And also, you're not doing your actual job. You're not doing the review. Right. So those are not particularly constructive.
It's very unhelpful, actually. The very short perfunctory reviews, either highly laudatory or highly critical, are pretty much useless to me. And then I have to pray that the other reviewer has actually done their job. And then I have this sort of supplementary material where I have to say either it's okay to listen to this person or don't listen to them. But yeah, I think a review, and it's not that they have to be pages long, but I think you need to have suggestions. If you have a gut feeling that this is the best paper you've ever read, it's probably good to have some points to sort of back up that argument to evidence it.
Yes, even if you're not asking for changes, explaining why.
Yeah.
Is a useful thing.
I mean, another thing that I don't find especially helpful, and I think that this is maybe generational, is the idea that something, that everything should be published unless it can't be, as opposed to picking from a large choice set, some papers that were all going to be okay, some of which will get to be published. And unfortunately, as editor, my job is actually to take all these submissions that go off a review and think, okay, of the whatever 50 papers we're going to publish this year, what's it going to be? Right. And so sometimes there are going to be rejections where the paper, it just needs to be resubmitted immediately somewhere else. It's just not going to be my journal. And I probably fail sometimes, but I try to be very transparent and helpful about this and say, I'm sending this back to you. I've issued a decision of reject. You should turn this around immediately and resubmit it elsewhere. It will find a home. But yeah, I mean, I'm not in the business of just publishing everything that surpasses a particular bar. That's not what we do.
Well, it sort of goes against the point of having a journal, right? I mean, we live in an era where everything can be published, can be accessible, can be referable, citable. To me, the point of journals is that we have an element of curation, of sort of steering where we think the field should go.
Yeah. I don't know. What do you think? Is there anything else you want to add, Levi, before I have a question?
No. I agree that journals have this curational aspect. So it's important for us to kind of exercise judgment. And in some of the rejection or desk rejection decisions that I make, I even say, I think this would be really good at this other journal. It's just not an EPB paper kind of thing. Yeah. So I think that that's useful in terms of like my role in helping the submitter, is to try and help them if they clearly haven't framed it or pitched it correctly, to try and give them a better alternative. But it can be hard to do that, especially with a paper that gets an extensive list of edits. You know, maybe this shouldn't be published yet.
Yeah, well, and I don't know that we had actually planned on talking a lot about this, but as everyone will know, if they're paying attention, you know, publishing is changing a great deal. And I don't really plan to open that conversation. But one of the pieces of this is that the publishers, certainly my publisher, is aiming to streamline rejection as much as possible so that it rolls papers over from one journal to another automatically without the authors having to do anything, which I think is hugely detrimental to the curation for individual journals, but also for what authors are coming to expect of publication, because I think what they're coming to expect from that kind of process is that that their submission was publishable, right? That just needs to keep going until it lands somewhere. Whereas I feel like when I've rejected something, it needed work. It can't automatically be rolled over to another journal because these people now need to go away and they need to actually do some improvements fundamentally, almost always, on the paper itself before it gets resubmitted somewhere else. And so I've actually turned off that option for authors at Geographical Analysis. I don't want to see anyone else's rejections automatically. I want authors to take these papers and think about where they want to place them next. And I know that that slows the process down, but I think, I don't know, maybe we would all agree we could do with some slowing down. We don't need to have masses and masses and masses of papers coming out. And fewer good papers is much better than a whole bunch of 70% stuff that eventually landed in a journal that's not as good as it would have been had you done a little bit of extra work. But it means that expectations, I think, for authors are changing also really quickly about how they think publication is supposed to work. The one thing that we don't want to actually take up as a community is, why don't people just submit less? That does not seem to be a thing that we're willing to countenance. Everything else is about about throughput. How can we move more stuff through the system more efficiently? We should pay the reviewers because there are more papers. We should do this. We should do that. Well, what if we just all submitted fewer papers? Then the system can maybe reach a new equilibrium. I think it's the larger context of publishers making a whole bunch of profit off of this that you know, makes it extra complicated. But I think
wanting to adopt technical fixes for what's fundamentally a social and infrastructural problem about the way that we fund and reward science.
Yeah. So the question I had for you is, because I used to spend a lot of time on social media, I'm quickly not spending so much time on social media anymore, but in sort of the academic Twitter or academic chatter, a topic that would come up a lot is that it just takes forever to either get a decision on a paper or to get a paper published. And so I thought we can maybe talk a little bit about what's taking so long. And I have to say, anecdotally speaking, that when I talk to people about editing, it's a pretty common conversation I have to hear somebody say, my students had a paper in review at Journal X. It's been 15 months. Nothing is happening. When I email the editor, we don't get a response at all. We're not really sure what to do. And I have to say, I think it's completely inappropriate. So if there are editors listening today, you need to make sure that people are getting decisions in timely fashions, and you have to reply to your email. And I will say, the caveat that I have to say for this is that I think for a lot of our journals, you get an email for every single thing. So I get a lot of automatic notifications from the system. And so actual emails from human beings can be kind of hard to find if I'm not really, really, really paying attention. Sometimes I have to go back and just dig and make sure I haven't missed any human beings and all of these automatic notifications that, like, I can now issue a decision on a paper or reviewer choices are due on a paper or a paper has just been submitted. But anyway, so what makes things take so long?
Yeah, I mean, so I don't know about y'all. We've talked a little bit about it, but like, I only have time to edit pretty much once a week. And I do that and I try and make sure that I get through the stack of things that need to make a movement, add more reviewers, make a decision. But if the paper comes in after that window for that week, then I might not be able to get to it for another week. And that's kind of the way that editing works, I think, in a lot of these cases. So there is a natural delay built into the system that every point a human touches the manuscript, there's going to be a lag. Now, 15 months is a hell of a lag. So I'm not exactly sure what happens in those cases. But I know that personally, the things that most of the time that I've seen these kinds of issues are when you just can't get reviewers for a manuscript and they just drag on and on and on. It can be quite challenging in that case. But I know that I think that something we've been saying a lot is that these systems are built by people and they work because we all do these things. But I think it's just slow when you're passing from person to person to person, and our expectations of rapid publication might need to change.
Yeah.
Well, also not idea, but maybe a bit of context that I'm not sure everyone is aware of. I think people conflate the sort of big profits of publishers with, and then equate them with the editors as if we were employed directly. And I don't know you too, but I do not make a whole lot of money out of these. It's part of my job, but it's an extra thing that I have to juggle with everything else that, yes, you commit to, but, you know, there isn't a you know, it's not a job as an employment, so to speak, of where there is a salary and so on. So I think, you know, I always think of people when they say, well, why have they not got back to me? And then, well, why did your review take 7 weeks last time when it was supposed to be 4 and you accepted it and said 4? And it's because we're humans and because there, you know, it's a chain of events that requires, you know, where every delay is compounded. I think that's the other point of Levi. There's no compensation. Is everything that happens and then next.
Yeah.
I think, too, a good rule of thumb is that if your manuscript requires at least 2 reviewers to review, then you should probably anticipate reviewing at least 2 manuscripts for the journal that you've submitted to. When there's an asymmetry in that relationship, when we don't review kind of proportional to the amount that we publish, it ends up making it so that effective review is really scarce. And there is a sense in which publishing is a reciprocal relationship to reviewing. So I know that I find it quite challenging when, you know, someone submits a paper to EPB, let's say, and then marks them as permanently unavailable for peer review. Those kinds of it breaks the system of incentives and the expected kind of reciprocity in the system. So I don't know if they, you know, do this at the other journals, you know, but I find that so frustrating.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever had somebody who's permanently unavailable. Oh, interesting. Well, so the other thing that's sort of interesting is that the communities of reviewers that we draw on, these pools, they overlap so strongly, but they're also very distinct. And that means that they can have distinct characteristics in terms of personality traits as well, probably. But I mean, for me, so yeah, I would say part of what makes things take so long is that I do this once a week and people often miss the window. But also there are several stages that a paper is going to go through. And so it sounds like for your journals, there are lots of different humans who are managing these different stages. For me, it's all the same person. So when I log in, I am first the administrator who handles the manuscript. And then if I say yes, you know, I assign it to an associate editor who is me. And then I get an email saying that you now have a paper assigned to you. And then I have to go in and I have to find reviewers. And then assuming that people agree to review and the reviews come in, then I have to make a recommendation as associate editor. And then I get an email as editor in chief that it's ready to make a decision. So I have found this actually to work pretty well for me in terms of managing workflow, because papers move into these different buckets. And there are some buckets that are relatively quick to go in and handle. So for example, new papers that come in that need to be checked and just read, that's a whole different mindset for me than either finding reviewers or making decisions. I find that finding reviewers is a different kind of work that often involves a lot of internet and a lot of reading and poking around and trying to get my head around who I might not be seeing in the community for that paper. And then decisions actually requires some thought, because I believe that we should write decisions, and that means having a few sentences at least that say, here's what I think you should do, here's what you should pay attention to, here's what I think the main messages are. So what makes things take a long time, even at GA, because I've definitely had papers that have taken forever to get decisions on. So one of them is that when people submit papers, they're not ready for me to process one way or the other. So people's names are on the papers. the proofs haven't loaded correctly. So when I go to look at a figure, it'll be a black box, for example. And so I find myself being increasingly frustrated that it seems like people don't actually look all the way through the proof to make sure that it's ready for a reviewer to look at. And you should be asking yourself the question, are reviewers going to like my paper if they find it really frustrating to get through whatever this proof looks like? What you see in that PDF proof, that's what the reviewers are going to see. So if figures are illegible, right, if something's too small or too big or in the wrong place, that is precisely what they're also going to see. So a really good example of this is where to place tables and figures in papers. I'd be sort of curious if you guys have the same feeling that I do. But the advice that I give, and what I think reviewers seem to like, is to have the figures embedded inside the text, even if they're lower quality, and then they're also uploaded individually so they appear at the end of the paper. This allows reviewers to read a paper on a screen and not as a printout. They will like it so much better if they've had a chance to look at this stuff in context. But it also means checking to make sure you don't have your name somewhere or anything identifiable, take that out, because otherwise I have to send it back to you. And by the time you resubmit it, you may wait another week for me to make a decision. But a few months ago, I heard a complaint that a paper had been sitting in the part of the interface where editors needed to choose reviewers, and that they'd been sitting there forever, and clear their interpretation as authors was that the editor was not actually logging in to take care of this work. And I thought, well, no, what's actually happening probably is that no one's saying yes to reviewing your paper. And it's going to sit there until two people say yes. And once two people say yes, it's going to move over into the part of the system that is under review. So until it says under review, nobody's agreed, or two people anyway, haven't agreed to review your paper. So that whole process is murky, I think, from the outside, and can make it look like editors are not actually present, when actually editors might just be struggling to get reviewers. And then it can take a little while for me to make a final decision because I want to get it right. Another thing is I was going to say in defense of authors and maybe editors a little bit. I know one place where papers get lost is when reviewers are very, very, very late in turning in their review, because those papers go to sit in purgatory. And I have to actually go and look and see which papers are sitting in that black box purgatory of late reviews. And if I'm really, really busy, if you remember my little workflow, that is not part of my workflow. My workflow is processing papers, finding reviewers, making decisions. So I have to remind myself every few weeks to go look in that purgatory hole to see who is really, really late, and send little nudgy emails saying, please, 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 I eagerly await your review. So that can make things take a little bit extra time.
So I think with that in mind, then, it might be good to talk a little bit at the end here about how we kind of make editorial decisions at the end of the day. We've gotten all these, you know, reviews in. We've maybe gotten conflicting perspectives on a paper. Some people might say it's revisable. Some people may accept as is. Some might even say reject. And at the end of the day, we have to make a decision, right? So I wonder, have you ever had anybody that split across a reject and an accept as is?
Yes.
Yes?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you decide in those cases?
Well, no, as soon as somebody has suggestions for improvement, it's like rock, paper, scissors. Suggestions for improvement is always going to trump accept as is. And, you know, reviewers are human. Sometimes you don't know as an editor or as an author who spent a lot of time on your paper and who spent almost no time, right?
Sometimes you do.
fair, true.
It's a probability is proportional to the number of words, at least within some buckets.
That's true. But I think editors also know. So, you know, after editing for a while, you do tend to know who, for example, is always going to...
Yeah.
Say accept, who's never critical, or who always hits reject no matter what.
Yeah. And I think this goes to the point I was making before on why I don't follow necessarily the decision, or I don't care about the decision every reviewer says as much as why. Because the decision is ultimately our job as editors, right? It involves a lot more context. It involves the journal. It involves other things. And sometimes I think it's also, if you think of sort of the latent variable of every reviewer, what you were saying, right? So some people might like the paper actually just as much, but that might mean major revisions for one, and another one, you know, almost accepts as his. And I think you get that calibration by reading the reports and saying, okay. And I say this almost on every review. Reviewer two will recommend X, but if you read through the comments, it could also be taken as, or if you take these comments with the other reviewer, which the reviewer two has not read, obviously, I think collectively this is what it means, and this is why I'm making this decision.
Right. Well, so for me, for example, if somebody recommends reject and then says, yes, they're willing to review a paper again, that gives me so much latitude. I mean, that is the equivalent of saying, okay, major revisions, especially if the other reviewer has said major revisions. And so I'm looking at lots of different information at the same time. And part of it is trying to get a handle on the state of the paper, the expected potential state of the paper, but also, am I going to be able to get it across the line? Like, so if it comes back, will I be able to find reviewers for it? If it eventually does come back, is it actually going to be a good fit for the journal by the time they've done these things?
I know that for me, I find it interesting at the point of making a decision, especially when you have a split decision, to think about the contrast between, let's say, if the person provided any recommended reviewers and then other reviewers that I've contacted. In my experience, at least, recommended reviewers can be much harsher on the person than the people that I've sought out. And I find it so fascinating that in a lot of these cases, my responsibility then becomes trying to figure out what level of expertise is appropriate to apply in this critique. You know, if we're all being judged by these people that we think are super experts in the topic, and they're all very critical, which is good, at some point that almost needs to be moderated if the journal is going to publish anything. So I often wonder the extent to which, you know, you balance these competing voices, because there are people that we know that are very critical all the time, and often they might even be coming in as a recommended reviewer. So I wonder if you guys have any reflections on that kind of thing. How do you balance the diversity of viewpoints on a manuscript when it comes time to make that decision?
I mean, where I land is that I think we should accept that this is a pretty subjective process, and so some types of papers are going to be more likely to get published than other types of papers because of the communities that they belong to. And sometimes editors are going to have their fingers on the thumbs of the scale of what gets published, and that's just a fact of life. And maybe we could want to try and not have that be the way it works. And this isn't about playing favorites. It's simply that there probably is conscious and unconscious decision-making happening when we choose reviewers for papers. That means that some papers are going to have an easier time and some are going to have a harder time. And I bet that we don't even always know we're doing it when we're doing it, would be my hypothesis, and that we should just acknowledge that this is maybe a feature and not a bug. Yeah. I certainly don't think we should try and clean it out of the system, but I think that it behooves all of us when we have a paper that has a really good review, smooth review process, not to think that we've just written like the best thing ever, but that maybe there was an editor and maybe there were some reviewers. Maybe there were lots of things helping us along the way that got us to that outcome. And we should just, I don't know, pay it forward probably.
Yeah, I think to me, it goes back to the, when we discussed before about the editorial line, if we can call it that way, about part of our job is determining whether the paper is good enough, whether it's finished enough, whether it's correct, and so on. But the journals, at least that I'm in, they also have an editorial element of, and this is, I think, an explicit, and I don't think is the only way to go, or that all journals should be like that. PLOS ONE, for example, is probably the most famous example I know of, where their guidelines say we publish correct results, and so long as they're correct, we will publish them. And the philosophy there is you publish it and then the market of ideas will sort of work its magic afterwards, which is one way. And I think it's good that we have some examples like that. But I think it's also interesting that we have examples where people who, you know, with more or less, but definitely if I think of the two journals, definitely that I'm part of, definitely the editors-in-chief and to a certain extent everyone else involved in the process, there are people who've been around for a while and who have a sense of where the field is going and perhaps where they think it should be going. And, you know, that's an element of of Sphere that is part of the system. So long as you know it, I think it's okay with me at least.
I agree. I think there's a corollary though, which is why at the beginning when we were talking about what journals we edit, and I said, I think I'm nearing the end of my term. It's not because I'm tired of geographical analysis. It's not, I don't think, because geographical analysis is tired of me. It's that I will have at the end edited for 8 years, which will be the longest anyone has ever edited this journal. And because I do think I'm idiosyncratic, I acknowledge that, I think it's really important to have editorial turnover. I think I think there are two parts to this corollary. One is that we need to have editorial turnover for a variety of reasons, but one of which is the freshness of viewpoints. The other is that we really want to build expertise across the board and give lots of people an opportunity to do this. But the other is that I'm going to go ahead and out myself as somebody who, as believing, I don't think you should edit more than one journal at a time. I think that we don't have so many publication outlets that that we can afford to have fewer voices opening and closing the gate. So we need turnover, but also overlaps happen, right? I mean, so for example, if I were offered, there are some journals that I would love to edit. If I were offered the opportunity to edit those journals, I would absolutely take on that job as I was winding down geographical analysis. And for a while, I would be one of those people wearing two hats. But I don't think it should be in sort of an equilibrium state. I don't think it's healthy for us.
I'll respond, since I do have two hats that have not been translation, or at least...
Yeah, but you're different. It's different.
I'm part of the system, so I want to make it clear, but I don't think it's part of, ultimately my decision to make it optimally.
Sure, but you're associate editor. You're not editor in chief, so I think that is a distinction.
Yes.
I think it's an important distinction, and I think I was thinking very, very narrowly about journals that fall into the remit of, say, geography or regional science or, I don't know, something urban, where it's a very clear community of people and there aren't that many journals, right? There aren't that many journals. And so if you have one person as editor-in-chief of more than one of those journals...
Yeah, I don't know who would want that.
An example is that just when that person gets really busy, basically the process has just slowed down for two entire journals. And that's really hard for people who needed promotion and who need career progression. And we're less likely to have that blockage happen if we have lots of different people editing journals. But yeah. I don't know. Maybe our listeners will have opinions about this. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yes, indeed. If you do have an opinion about this, or indeed any other question about how it feels to be an editor or wanting advice on review, let us know your experiences at thegladpodcast@gmail.com. Write in, with an agony aunt story. What do I do? My paper's been under review for 8 months. Or we'd love to hear from you about your experiences on either side of the editorial desk. We'll hopefully have some more episodes coming up for you shortly. But other than that, we're glad you're here,